once again to a new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host Matt. We're coming to you from Dayton, Ohio, the true Windy City, on this blustery weekend. And it's fitting that we're recording this right now during the Oscars, because a year after everyone wanted to talk about three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, we're here to talk about one billboard outside of Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, so the big news of the week, we had a lot of good games in the A-10, but I think the biggest news was the Fire Mooney Mafia putting up a billboard in Richmond, Virginia, calling for their head coach to be fired in a very bold move, I must say.
So, we have now since discovered as time has passed that, as expected, the group known as the Fire Mooney Mafia was responsible for this. No big surprise there. This is a group of very, very passionate Spiders fans who have been seeking change for a long time. And if you really want a good explanation of why they put up the billboard, just check out their Twitter account. They went through a whole run of tweets on Friday, I believe, in which they explained their motives for it and then why they were taking down the billboard after just one day. But whether you agree with the action of putting up the billboard or not, I think we were all pretty entertained by this.
Yeah, this was definitely interesting. I mean, we've seen a lot of good tweets from them over the last two seasons, but I didn't know they would actually take it this far. The interesting thing is that this was not the best time to put it up. Richmond's actually playing pretty well. They got destroyed by their rival VCU, but other than that, they've won 4 out of 5, and now they're 6-8 overall in the A-10. It looks like they're safe from playing on Wednesday in the A-10 tournament. So interesting timing, and I understand the frustration, but I'm just not sure this was a good moment, given that they're actually playing well for the first time all year. Maybe they should have done it when they lost their season opener to Longwood or something like that.
Yeah, and I go back and forth as to whether or not I think Chris Mooney should be back next year. Right now, with the Spiders starting to heat up, I'm slightly leaning towards yes. And I really don't think he's going to get fired just because he became their all-time winningest coach this season. And you really just don't fire your coach after that kind of milestone. But I really commend these guys. If you're willing to put in the money to pay for something like this, I don't know how much a billboard costs, but it certainly can't be cheap. And if you're passionate enough to really put your message out like this, I give you a round of applause.
I just wonder, though, with that, do you think they got any of their financial investment back? They already took it down after about 24 hours, so I'm hoping they didn't waste too much on this.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't going to make any kind of financial gain with it. This was a purchase of passion.
Just to send a message. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know, I go back and forth on this. We've talked a lot about Mooney, though, whether or not he should be fired. I even brought this up before the season even started. And like you said, I'm starting to lean the other way that maybe he should come back. The Spiders have had some tough circumstances the last couple seasons. Before the year, they lost Quan Four as a transfer, and then Demonte Buckingham was dismissed from the program. Early on in the year, they lost Nick Sherrod to a season-ending injury, so they already had a pretty thin roster, and now that's just even worse at this point. So I'm not sure how much you can put on Mooney at this point, but I don't know. It's just tough because you understand the frustration of Richmond fans, but at the same time, Mooney has accomplished a lot in his years with the Spiders.
Yeah, I really don't want to go too deep rehashing the Mooney argument right now. We're going to have to see how this season plays out, and probably much more importantly, we're going to have to see if all of their promising young guys decide to come back next year. That's probably more dangerous for him than a big losing streak to end the season. But my final passing thought on the billboard, you know, Fire Mooney Mafia, while some people have disagreed with your tactics, the one thing that no one should disagree with is your passion. And if you truly believe that this is what's best for the Spiders program, then we're not going to badmouth you in any way. So keep fighting for Richmond basketball, no matter what way you think is appropriate.
Yeah, you know, if anybody was ever going to put up a billboard asking or calling for their coach to be fired, I never would have expected it to happen at a mid-major like Richmond. I would have figured it would be somewhere like Indiana, where after two seasons, fans are already getting tired of Archie Miller. And I just can't believe it happened somewhere in the A-10, so that's pretty funny to me. But anyway, now that we've gone over some of the most pressing news recently, let's go across the city of Richmond to VCU, who currently stands as the A-10's best chance to receive an at-large bid to the NCAA tournament, and most likely the only chance the A-10 has at this point.
So, last thing with the billboard before we move into this. You mentioned Indiana. If I would have ever expected to see someone do this, I would have expected the guys down in Big Blue Nation to put together a billboard, maybe in the back in the day, to get Billy Gillespie or Tubby Smith fired. But moving on to VCU, it's got to be feeling pretty good to be a Richmond Rams fan at this point. They're sitting at 21-6, 12-2 in the A-10, with a very nice 3-4 quadrant one record against teams in that top quadrant in the net. So for those of you unfamiliar with this, the RPI is gone this year. The net is now taking over as the committee's evaluation tool. And so quadrant one consists of home games against the top 30, neutral site games against the top 50, and away games against the top 75. So for VCU, they have a pair of very nice road wins at Texas and at Dayton, plus a neutral site win over Temple. There are two most impressive wins beyond that, both come in quadrant two, home victories over Dayton and Hofstra. Really the only things dragging down their resume, they're 7-2 against quadrant three. Those two losses were the home blunder late in non-conference against Charleston, and then on the road against Rhode Island, who's not even good enough at this point to make a road game against them be in the quadrant two.
Yeah, that's a good point about Rhode Island. At the time, I didn't really think that would kill VCU's resume, because at that point, the other Rams were still in the middle of the pack in the A-10, but ever since then, they've just fallen apart, and that could hurt VCU's resume. At this point, though, I think VCU, the name of the game is just avoiding bad losses. They have four games left this season, and they don't have any chances for good wins. They do go at George Mason, which could be decent. That may slip into the quadrant two range. But as long as they avoid disaster, dropping a home game against one of the bottom teams in the A-10, I think they should be fine at this point. Their resume holds up, and we say this every year, but the bubble isn't very good. And VCU, it's just hard to keep a team with so many wins out of the tournament.
So at the moment, George Mason sits at 152, which is actually lower than Rhode Island, so they still have a little bit of a ways to go to get into Quadrant 2, but if they could upset the Rams, that would probably do a lot towards putting them there. As for the rest of VCU's resume, they sit at 34 in the net. They would actually be 25 if we were still using the RPI. They're in the mid-30s in ESPN's BPI. They're 40th in KenPom. There seems to be a general consensus that the Rams are somewhere between like the 32nd and 40th best team in the country. And typically, where you start to cut off the at-large bids is somewhere in the mid to low 40s, in the 44, 45, 46 range. So, still a little bit of work to do for the Rams, but they're at 12-2 right now. They are hurtling towards that magic number of 15-3. I've said all season 15-3 in the A-10 should be enough to get VCU into the tournament. 14-4 starts to make things a little shaky. But the Rams are in great shape now. Really the only truly terrible loss they could still suffer is home against St. Joe's. Losing a road game to Richmond or George Mason wouldn't be ideal, nor would be losing at home to SLU. But no one's going to look at one of those three losses and really see it as a huge black mark on their resume. I think for VCU, 3-1 from here on out, and they should start feeling pretty safe about where they're going to be heading into Brooklyn.
See, I think 3-1, I think that gets them in. 4-0 would lock them into the field for me. I think 3-1, If they did that and then didn't have a good showing in Brooklyn, they could definitely be on their way to the first four, I think. And the thing that worries me is just recent history with the A-10 in Selection Sunday. We all know about how the Bonnies got snubbed a few years ago. In VCU's resume, I think it's probably better than the Bonnies that season just because their win at Texas was better than anything the Bonnies did back in 2016. But I'm always scared about that. You don't know how the committee will react with using the new net system. Who knows how much that will change, whether it benefits mid-majors. I feel like the NCAA wouldn't do anything to actually help the small guys because that doesn't help TV ratings. So I'm just a little bit worried about VCU. There's only one way to guarantee your spot in the field, and I do think there's a good chance that they do win the A-10 tournament. I would put them as the favorite. But they just, if they go 4-0, they're in. I don't think they need to worry about it. So just these last four games, if they take care of business, they should be fine.
So Joe Lenardi has them as an 11. Ever since the whole Bonaventure debacle, he's tended to be a little bit more conservative with A-10 teams. I don't know if that's just reactionary to what happened with the Bonnies, or with he himself being an A-10 man, just wants to make sure that he's not giving any bias towards the A-10, and maybe just knocking a team down a line helps to confirm in his mind that he's not distorting his view of them. But very interestingly, Jerry Palm of CBS, who I would say is probably the second most widely talked about bracketologist, has the Rams all the way up as a 9. I don't think that's going to happen. Maybe if they win out from here on out, they could get to a 9. But I really don't believe that they're there right now. The interesting thing for me is if they go 3-1 here and then lay an absolute egg in the quarterfinals, then we get the really fun scenario of finding out whether Dayton fans just hate VCU or they still want to root for the conference. Because in that scenario, I see the first four in the Rams' future.
Yeah, that's a good point. Last year was definitely a very pro-St. Bonaventure crowd, and part of that was the Bonnie fans always do a great job of traveling the UD arena across, and they travel everywhere, but especially UD is one of the best for them. And the neutral Dayton fans, they definitely also help them out. I don't know, I feel like they would root for VCU. I feel like it's a pretty small portion, a small but vocal portion of the fan base that sternly roots against the Rams. It would be interesting, though. I just think you have to support your A-10 teams. It's not like Dayton and VCU, they haven't been in the same conference that long, so it's not like it's a super heated rivalry or anything like that.
Yeah, we might have to cut that part out of the podcast. We don't want Dayton Twitter or Richmond Twitter or George Mason Twitter coming back at us. Because as we learned earlier this season, there's a lot of fans, at least in the Twitterverse, that would rather just see VCU completely crash and burn than see the A-10 succeed.
Well, that's where I say that it's small but vocal. You know, I'm tired of watching VCU beat my Dayton Flyers time and time again, and if they beat them a third time in the A-10 tournament, I will be very upset. But I feel like, let me put it this way, the old people that show up to Dayton games wearing sweater vests are much more likely to root for VCU than the Dayton fans on Twitter. And I feel like there's going to be a lot of people wearing sweater vests at UD Arena for the first four. So let me, that's just to clarify my thoughts on this matter. Alright, so speaking of VCU, we think there's a pretty good chance that they're getting in the field at this point. Just wanted to bring this up. Saw this tweet this morning by @HaslamMetrics, who had Dayton and Davidson as his 7th and 8th teams out of, or they're the 7th and 8th teams out of the field right now. And I think that partly just shows that there aren't a whole lot of bubble teams with strong cases. I don't see it happening for either of these teams. I think we'd both agree at this point they kind of missed their chances to rack up enough quality wins. And, you know, they both have, I guess, I hate to say this, they have reasonable NIT resumes, which is about the best they can hope for in terms of an at-large. But it is nice to see them being mentioned in the conversation, albeit not very seriously.
So ever since Dayton beat Davidson on the road on Tuesday, the Wildcats seemingly disappeared from the conversation in just about everywhere except for this bracket. Dayton has started to get a little bit of run in the last few days. Joe Lenardi at one point had them as his eighth team out. I think they cycled out of that spot in the last day or two. Another bracket, I believe it was three-man weave, had them as one of their teams to watch outside the bubble. I just don't buy it for either team. For Davidson, they have the home win over VCU, but with the Rams being at 34, that's four spots off from being a quadrant one victory. I find it hard to believe, and obviously we don't have much of a track record with the net, but I do find it hard to believe that someone's going to make the tournament without a quadrant one win, especially given that they have three quadrant three losses at St. Joe's, at Wake Forest, at UMass. You can make the argument for a team like Wofford over in the SoCon right now, who doesn't have an incredible slate of wins, but only have four losses for the entire season, and have just been rampaging through the SoCon. But it's tough to make the argument for a team like Davidson, who's 66th in net, and has both bad losses and no big wins. I think Dayton has a better argument, but I'm not going to sit here and pretend like it's a great one. Maybe if the Flyers went out, they could get themselves to 24 wins going into the A-10 final. That obviously looks attractive. But they're not going to see VCU before the final unless they drop at least one more game. And without beating VCU, they're going to have the same problem as the Wildcats. They actually have two quadrant one wins, neutral site against Butler, and then the road win at Davidson. But neither of those are blowing anyone's socks off. The home loss to George Mason is really going to hurt them. I just don't see it for the Flyers or the Wildcats at this point. Although I will say, Dayton maybe by some miracle can work their way in. I don't see how Davidson would get in.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. The problem is, Dayton and Davidson, I think either one of them would have a reasonable chance if they beat VCU one more time this year, or in Dayton's case, if they beat them for the first time. But the problem is, at this point, VCU, they're most likely going to get the one seed in the A-10 tournament. There's a good chance that Dayton and Davidson will be the 2 and 3 seeds in either order. At this point, Davidson's more likely to get the 2, but it doesn't make a huge difference for this argument. If either of them play VCU in Brooklyn, it will be in the final. And at that point, it's a win and you're in scenario. So if one of them had a game at VCU to finish out the regular season, maybe this conversation would be different. But right now, neither team plays anybody that great to finish the year. Dayton's best game left is at Duquesne. I think Davidson might play the Bonnies. And there's no chances for quality wins left to at least make a difference in the committee's eyes.
So at this point, neither team's going to pick up another quadrant one win. Really, the only possibilities for quadrant two wins from here on out, for Dayton, at Duquesne, could potentially get up there if the Dukes make a slight jump. And then if these two meet in the semifinals, neutral against each other would be a quadrant two win for whoever takes that game. But that's about it. There's just not that many chances in a down year.
So I think most A-10 fans would agree at this point. VCU, Davidson, and Dayton are the three best teams in the conference in some order, and we'll discuss that later. But after that, it gets a little bit interesting. Right now, 4 through 7... and the A-10 is very close. Each team has a reasonable chance to get that last fourth spot and get the double bye. And so right now we're going to go into talking about which one of those teams and others that could maybe make a surprise run in Brooklyn. So to start off, I'm going to go with St. Bonaventure. They're currently the front runner, actually, for the fourth spot due to tiebreakers. They would get a double bye if the season ended today. And right now, the Bonnies are just on fire. Ever since they got blown out at home against VCU, they've just been playing some great basketball. 4 wins in a row for them. And I just think the key for them, to me, obviously Kyle Lofton is making headlines as one of the best freshmen in the conference, but the Bonnies are very experienced. They're one of the few teams in the conference with three seniors that are in their rotation, in Courtney Stockard, Nelson Caputo, and Ladarian Griffin. So I think the Bonnies, obviously they got off to a terrible start this year, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them make a little bit of noise in the A-10 tournament.
So at this point, it becomes tougher and tougher to find sleepers. I think the top and the bottom just continue to put together a wider gap in between the two. Maybe the Bonnies make some noise. Maybe George Mason makes some noise, although I'm fading on that. At this point, I think that the best sleeper potential outside of the top three has to be either the Bonnies or Duquesne. The Dukes are sitting at 9-5 in conference. Four of those five losses are to the current top four. They gave Davidson a great game on the road. They lost to VCU without Sincere Carey. They lost at Dayton, which, honestly, plain and simple, is a game that they shouldn't have won when you're playing on the road against an elite team in the conference. They laid an absolute egg against the Bonnies in a game where both teams just played absolutely horrendously. And then the At-LaSalle loss, with the Explorers starting to slip, that's the one that kind of hurts. They had that game in their hands, let it get away in the final seconds. But what this team has shown us is that they're incredibly resilient. They come back from 18 down, sorry, actually it's 19 down, against George Mason on the road. Sincere Carey's not playing. Tavian Dunn-Martin is carrying a far heavier load than he is typically used to as their sixth man. Responds by not only getting through the whole game with still plenty of energy left in his legs, but putting up 22 points. I just think that when it gets into Brooklyn and the games get tight, you need a team that's going to be extremely confident in themselves. And the one thing that has become very clear about Duquesne is that they have a lot of confidence in themselves, and they really like playing with each other. I don't know what's going on in those locker rooms at halftime, but seven double-digit comebacks in one season is not a fluke. When you get up to a number like that, there's clearly some sort of resiliency gene in a bunch of these players. As for a deep sleeper, you know, St. Joe's has the talent, but they keep doing stupid stuff, like up late in a game against UMass trying to throw a full-court pass when you're going to just get fouled anyway, and then the ball soars out of bounds for a turnover. It's been plays like that all season for St. Joe's. I guess if I had to pick somebody at the bottom to potentially make like a semifinal run that we don't expect, I'm probably going to kick myself for this. It might be Richmond. Because so many of the bottom teams are trending in the wrong direction. The Spiders are starting to play some good basketball. And you can see guys like Nathan Kao are clearly just getting more comfortable as the season goes on. Now, for them, they're at this point, if they keep playing well, they're going to end up in the 8-9 game, which sets them up for a rivalry battle with VCU in the quarters. But if that happens, I wouldn't exactly say that the Spiders have no shot in that game. I think Richmond might be the team to surprise us if a team comes out of the bottom.
Yeah, Richmond, they are one of the few bottom teams moving in the right direction. I actually had St. Joe's written down just because they do have a really talented couple of guys on their roster. Charlie Brown could easily take over a couple games and make a big run. Same with Jared Bynum or Lamar Kimball. And also, St. Joe's has won two recent A-10 tournaments, both in 2014 and 2016. So one more pick I have, and this is something I could kick myself for later on too, but St. Louis was picked first for a reason at the beginning of the season by the coaches. And obviously they've been one of the more disappointing teams. They're currently in 7th place. But defense wins championships, and even though it has declined in conference play, they're still one of the better defenses in the conference. And the same argument I had for the Bonnies, St. Louis also has three seniors in their rotation, Javon Best, Tremaine Isabel, and DJ Foreman, all getting a lot of minutes. And I just think that experience is something a lot of A-10 teams are missing. So I don't think there's a good chance, but I don't know. I think I like them more than Duquesne and George Mason at this point, just because their defense is better than each of those, in my opinion, and who knows? They have some talent. They haven't quite put it together, but I don't know. They were picked first for a reason. That's a bad argument, but it's about all I've got at this section of the standings. I'm not too sure what else to say. I would say we would both probably agree that the top three teams right now, Dayton, VCU, and Davidson, those are the three best chances, but these were just a few other kind of long shots, so to speak, that could make some noise.
Yeah, I'm out. I'm not putting anything behind the Billikens at this point. I just think that this is not the same team without Cartier Gordon. And people forget they actually ran off five straight to start A-10 play, so they're 3-6 since then. When you really dig deep, they had that one great performance at home against Dayton in a game where the Flyers just looked like they just had no interest in playing basketball that night. It was one of the two just most embarrassing performances of the year by the Flyers, the other being the game against Tulsa in December. But all credit to the Billikens for winning that game. It was not the best coach game of the year from Dayton. A lot of their guys looked like they weren't giving the best effort. They were killing them on the offensive boards. Like, I'm not sure St. Louis won that game because they played well so much as they won that game because Dayton just laid an absolute egg. And, I mean, the Billikens are 13-2 at home. They lose that advantage once they get to Brooklyn. Honestly, their second most impressive conference win is at LaSalle. This team is falling fast, and I just don't see them really turning it around. Especially with the fact that a brutal down-the-stretch schedule could just kill their confidence and potentially knock their seeding down to a point where they have to play VCU if they make it to the quarters.
Yeah, I'll agree. All right, St. Louis, they didn't. It's not like they played a perfect game against Dayton when they beat them in St. Louis, but I feel like that's almost part of their style. Something that, obviously they've gone through coaching changes and gone through a lot of classes of players, but it just seems to me that they play an ugly style of basketball, and they get their opponents to play down to their level. And I just feel like, with their experience, I don't know, I just think their defense, if they get hot, and maybe if they make a couple free throws, I know that's asking a lot, but if they can shoot like 70%, who knows? I just think experience is so key when you have to win back-to-back days.
So, with all of this being said, after spending all year talking about how wide open the A-10 tournament might be, I'm really starting to feel like there might only be three teams that are capable of winning it. VCU has obviously shown that they are the creme de la conference. They are the top of the line. This is an NCAA tournament team that is really starting to play their best basketball in mid to late February here. Dayton is either the most talented or second most talented team in the conference. Whether or not they're better than VCU is up for debate, although I think VCU fans will point to the two victories they have, and those are pretty good indicators. But I'd back just about all of my confidence in the fact that one of those two is most likely going to win the conference tournament. Dayton is really starting to play the right game. They're playing both offensive and defensive systems that don't ask their guys to do things that really just fail to utilize their athleticism. Now, Dayton is beating teams by the fact that they are more talented than them. And if they keep doing that, then they should be able to rampage their way to the final until they run into VCU. And who knows, maybe the Rams get upset along the way by like a Duquesne or a George Mason or a St. Bonaventure. Other than that, as I look around at the scenarios in which one of those two doesn't win, I could still see Davidson just getting hot over a three-day span. They have the best player in the conference in John Axel Goodmanson. You can't discount that. I'd put them at slim odds, but I still really think they can do this. I don't see who outside the top three is going to win it. And with St. Louis really slipping and falling off, it's kind of created a void below the top three.
Yeah, I would agree that those are definitely the top three. I think it's actually a lot closer than that. I would put VCU a hair ahead of each of those teams in terms of probability to win the A-10 tournament, just because, you know, all the metrics support them. They're 40th in KenPom, which is a good 20 to 30 spots ahead of Dayton and Davidson, but I think it's close after that. I know VCU, they did beat Dayton twice this year, but Dayton took them down to the wire both times. They were tied with a minute to go at the Siegel Center, and they had the lead with about 15 seconds to go in the rematch at UD Arena, so Dayton easily could have won either of those games. They really just came down to who could make the biggest play in the final minute of those games, and both times it happened to be Marcus Evans. Now, Dayton, they did beat Davidson, and they pounded them for about 32 minutes in that game before the Wildcats made a huge comeback down the stretch. And I think Dayton's the better team, although I do think it's close. I think part of it has to do with Dayton's big men just overmatching Davidson in the post. I think Davidson's just not a great matchup for the Flyers. All three of UD's big men, Cunningham, Toppin, and Mikesell, all three of them had big games, and so I just think that might be more of a matchup thing. But then in the other end, Davidson beat VCU in their only meeting this year, and while I would say VCU's the better team, it's still pretty close between them. So I do think other teams have a reasonable chance, or a non-zero chance, I would say, just because in a week-long tournament, anything can happen. I do think there's a really good chance that Dayton or Davidson steals a bid, though, just because even though VCU, they're the only team with an at-large resume at this point, I would say it's got to be a less than 50% chance they win the A-10 tournament.
I'd put it right at 50-50, especially because the A-10's just had such a penchant for bid thieves. This conference and the Mountain West have really been the two that have tortured teams along the bubble for years.
All right, so with that, we will get into our Twitter questions. And first from our longtime listener, Trent, who first asked us, how do the tiebreakers work in the A-10? And this is a relevant question because right now, as we talked about earlier, 4 through 7 in the conference, we're all very close, and any one of them could get the 4 seed in the tournament. So the first tiebreaker, as I believe all conferences operate, is head-to-head. So if you only play one time and you win, then you have the tiebreaker over that team. It gets more complicated when you play a home-and-home, and this also happens to be an issue this year because a lot of those teams in contention for the 4th spot did play each other twice. So, right now there aren't a whole lot of tiebreakers that have already been settled. Duquesne just beat George Mason a couple days ago, so they will have a tiebreaker over the Patriots. But after that, I don't think anything has been settled. St. Louis, for example, still hasn't played George Mason or St. Bonaventure. Those are all coming up in the last few games, and those games will have huge implications for A-10 tournament seeding. But after that, there's a few teams that have already played twice. George Mason and St. Bonaventure split their season series, and that's where the 3rd tiebreaker comes into play, which is record against the highest common opponent. So in the case of George Mason and St. Bonaventure, both of them lost to VCU, but George Mason does have a chance against VCU, so if they beat them at home, they would have the tiebreaker over the Bonnies. They both lost to Davidson, and then George Mason beat Dayton. So it actually looks like George Mason should have the tiebreaker in that situation. There's a few other examples out there. Duquesne and St. Louis still have to play, although Duquesne beat them the first time. And in that case, they both lost to VCU, Davidson, but St. Louis beat Dayton. So right now, they would have the tiebreaker if they came back to beat Duquesne. But it gets more complicated because Duquesne still gets another shot at Dayton. And at that point, I'm not really sure what would happen. I think it would come down to whoever beat St. Bonaventure or something like that. At this point, I'm pretty much confusing myself, but that's what they have on the A-10 website. So it goes head-to-head, and then record versus highest common opponent. After that, I'm pretty sure it's just a coin flip, which, given how close everything is this year, It's certainly possible that we could have something like that happen to determine seeding.
So, Trent also asked us to discuss our picks right now for Defensive Player of the Year and for Most Improved Player of the Year. So, going into Most Improved, sometimes this award can be pretty obvious when you get a guy who went from the end of the bench to becoming an all-conference performer. That really didn't happen this year. It's a mix of guys who went from being on the outside of the rotation to becoming really good rotation players, or guys who were maybe the fourth or fifth guy on their team who emerged to become a star. Now, one thing that I personally did not consider for this award is any transfers. Obviously, we can look up the stats of these guys, but we didn't really watch any of these guys play in person 2 years ago. And then obviously freshmen don't have a basis to go off of. So after kind of scanning through, I saw four guys that I would really put in heavy contention for this award. The two who are a little bit more on the outside, Richmond's Jacob Gilliard, who's bumped up his points per game by about 5, his assists per game by 1. The stats don't really show much besides a guy who's just become a better scorer. But for me, part of it is just the fact that he's now been forced to take on a more challenging role in Richmond's offense as their lead guard, and I think he's responded really well. One other guy that I would put there with him, Justin Kyer of George Mason. He's gone from a solid starter for the Patriots, which is just about what you would define him as the last 2 years, to now being one of their two best players. Points per game up about 4 a game. Rebounds up about 2. His assists are the same. Slightly more steals and blocks. I think he's been good, but I just don't think he's made enough of a jump up to compete with the two guys that I have at the top right now.
Yeah, I considered both Kyer and Gilliard. They did improve their stats, but I didn't feel that it was right to give them most improved. Just because they were both very good last year, so I was looking more at guys that didn't have as big of an impact last year. So, I would say at this point, I would have to give my most improved to Marcus Santos Silva of VCU. Averaged just 3 points and 3 rebounds a game as a freshman last year. Now he's up to about 10 points and 7 rebounds. Solid defensive player. He's really stepped up for them. Reminds me a bit of one of our favorites in Mo Alie-Cox. And also he has a little bit of Justin Tillman in him. Just a very strong post player, and I've been very impressed. I think he will develop into one of the best big men in the A-10.
So, Santos Silva was my number two. He did more than triple his points per game. He more than doubled his rebounds per game. And the context of what he's done for VCU, if you go back and listen to our preseason pod, which at this point we would like to ask you not to do, because we both were way off on VCU. It was really the only egregious error that either of us had. But my biggest concern was, well, VCU had a bad defense last year, even with Justin Tillman manning the paint. And we looked around and we couldn't find who was going to be that next stud big man for VCU. Well, it turns out that it's Marcus Santos Silva. And without him, there's no way VCU's in the middle of the tournament conversation. He's been great for them. He's going to be averaging double-digit points, possibly even double-digit rebounds next season. It's been a really nice step up for him this year. But for me, I'm more interested in the guy who went from essentially a guy who in his sophomore year was a notch below where Santos Silva is now, but had himself as a legitimate Player of the Year candidate as late as a week ago. And that's Cyril Langevin of Rhode Island. Points per game goes from 6.1 to 14.2. Rebounds from 5.8 to 10.3. He's still a great presence in the paint on defense. But this was a guy in his first 2 seasons at Rhodey that when we saw him go in the game when Hassan Martin came out to rest, we assumed he was just there to put his hands up, grab a few rebounds, and to use all 5 of his fouls. And what has now happened is that he's the bright spot in an otherwise dark late season for Rhodey. He's going to be a preseason first team All-A-10 next year. he might make the first team All-A-10 this season. I can't possibly see him falling any farther than the second team. And he's become a true star. And so for me, the fact that he has elevated himself as into one of the five or six best players in the conference is what causes me to give Ciro Langevin my MIP with 2 weeks to go.
Yeah, Langevin's a really good pick. His stats definitely back that up. I think part of the reason is going into the season, I had higher expectations for him than Santos Silva. But that is a good pick. One more guy I want to mention, because we didn't really consider transfers too much for this, but DJ Williams from GW averaged only 2 points in his 2 years at Illinois, and he's up to 15 now this year for the Colonials. Really great season for him. And before we move on from this question, you mentioned our preseason pod and that our egregious mistake, you said that was our only one, discounting VCU. I just want to point out, I had UMass at 5th going into the season. That was a big mistake, and I'm sorry. I bought into the hype. I was very wrong on that one.
So he also asked us about Defensive Player of the Year. This was a very difficult one to figure out. And when I was also trying to figure out what my first team All-Defensive Team would be this year, I just kept going back to the fact that so many of the defenses in the A-10 have just had an up and down last 2 months. And for a moment, I was considering the cop-out answer of my first team All-Defensive Team is just the 5 VCU starters. Just given that that's been the one consistently great defense throughout in the A-10. But I decided to go with Hassan French of St. Louis. And as I research deeper over the next 2 weeks, this is something that very well could change. The biggest reason being his fouling issues and the fact that he's just not out on the court as much as he should be. But he is a truly elite rim protector. And when you watch teams play St. Louis, they try to become more perimeter-oriented because they're afraid of French patrolling the paint. And that allows them to play right into the Billikens' hands with two other great defenders in Javon Bess and Jordan Goodwin on the perimeter. And while St. Louis has so many good choices, I just think that Bess and Goodwin wouldn't be quite as good if they didn't have French behind them.
Yeah, French is a great choice. Definitely one of the most intimidating defenders in the A-10. I also really like Osun Osuni for St. Bonaventure, leading the conference with 2.6 blocks per game. And he also had over 20 rebounds a couple weeks ago against Duquesne. Very impressive freshman campaign for him. A couple other guys, you mentioned Langevin. He's been a presence on the glass and blocking shots. We also talked about Jacob Gilliard earlier, but he's averaging 3.2 steals per game, which is almost a full steal over second place, which is Sincere Carey. And just going by the eye test, it's kind of tough because I feel like for a lot of defense, you really need to watch the games, and we watch as much as we can from other teams, but a couple guys that have impressed me are Javon Bess and then also John Axel Goodmanson, who just does everything for Davidson, but you know, your point about VCU, their team defense is by far the best in the A-10, and all 5 of their starters are just phenomenal defenders. Alright, so with that, we have one more listener question, and this comes from @BonaCommenter, a recent follower who I've greatly enjoyed reading his takes on the Bonnies, and he just asks, will St. Bonaventure win the national championship in 2022?
So, for those of you who don't want to do the math, this would be the senior season for their terrific freshman trio of Kyle Lofton, Osun Osuni, and Dominic Welch. They're going to be a really good team that year as long as all of these guys stay. And I say that knowing that Mark Schmidt has had a better time than most mid-major schools in being able to keep talented guys at his program for their whole 4 years. So I really have no reason to believe any of them will be gone. But one big thing that could really help the Bonnies, who, just knowing that they'll have those 3 guys and assuming they develop properly, you would think that they'd at least have the talent to make a Sweet 16 run that year. But we never know when the FBI scandal might strike. And maybe in the summer of 2021, the FBI goes really crazy, just starts arresting coaches, and Arizona gets put on probation, and all the Tobacco Road schools get the death penalty, and John Calipari is forced to retreat to the Caribbean to avoid getting brought in by the FBI on obstruction charges. And maybe just like 25 power conference programs just get suspended from the postseason that year. And at that point, all of a sudden, St. Bonaventure is looking great. Now, granted, this could also be a fear, too, because maybe Mark Schmidt's just an awesome recruiter, but they've brought some talented guys up to Olean, New York, which is not exactly one of the most desirable places in this country. So maybe there's a little bit of cash being exchanged up there, although instead of giving the duffel bags that you reportedly get when you show up to Louisville, they might just be occasionally slipping like a $10 bill in the back pocket of one of these guys' jeans, but who knows? Maybe the FBI will come through and the Bonnies get their one shining moment in 2022.
Yeah, you know, the FBI, if these scandals continue, who knows? Maybe by then the A-10 will be the last conference standing. I don't think there's a good chance of that, so my short answer is no, they will not win the championship that year. But they definitely could be good. I think they might take a small step back next year just because they lose Courtney Stalker, who I think we would both agree, one of the top players in the conference. And I don't know too much about their current recruiting, who they're bringing in next year, but as long as Mark Schmidt stays and he keeps these guys around, he's building a very solid core. And when these guys are all seniors, they could definitely have a special season.
So today, one disclaimer. We just want to remind everyone that we are analysts and not reporters. So when we joke about St. Bonaventure potentially paying their players, that is literally us just BSing around from our seats. We have no idea if that might be true or not. One error from today's pod did not come from us. It comes from ESPN.com. And I know many of you on A10 Twitter have seen this lately. But if you go on and pull up the profiles of the Dayton players, you will see a whole bunch of guys that we have no idea who they are. This goes all the way back to December when, during a game against Auburn on ESPNU or SEC Network, I don't remember at this point, the entire Flyers starting lineup was shown as different people in a picture that we'll post up on our Twitter if you haven't seen it yet. We don't know what's going on. We don't know why ESPN.com has zero clue who anyone on Dayton actually is. But it's pretty bad, and it's pretty funny if you want to go check it out.
The A10 gets no respect from ESPN.
And so with that, we want to thank everybody once again for listening to the 3Bid League podcast. Follow us on Twitter at the number 3Bid League pod. Send us any questions you have on there, or any feedback, good or bad, we'd love to hear from you. Please tell a friend. We're getting really close to the conference tournament. We're going to be ramping up the amount of episodes we do. And we personally think we're giving you guys some good content. So if you have anything that could make our show better, please let us know. If there's anything that you want us to keep doing, let us know. And please just tell a friend. We'll see y'all in Brooklyn.